Turning now to the first book of Samuel, chapter 17 and verse 1. 1 Samuel chapter 17, verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle. And we are going to be considering spiritual lessons from the lives of Saul and David. I was intending to proceed directly unto some of the respects in which David is a type of Christ and his conversion, but for various reasons I feel it better to leave that to just a little later in the series. And while we have the overlap between Saul and David, to focus just upon this and upon this remarkable and very well known 17th chapter of 1 Samuel. Now the Philistines, we learn in this chapter, have taken territory from right out of Judah. They're no longer on the boundary, threatening, ever threatening. They've now entered in and they've stationed themselves well within the country. And so, perhaps belatedly, Saul, we're not told how, but he has put out the signal, he has raised an army, and there are no doubt many thousands of Israelites and many thousands of Philistines. And in the opening verses of this chapter, we're told just exactly where it was and what the circumstances were. Now, the site for the intended battle or confrontation was a place where there are two very rocky hills, virtually mountains, and separating them a deep valley and a river running in that valley, a river, really a wadi, dry most of the year, but running with water only in the rainy seasons. And the armies are ranged on either side, to the north and to the south. Well, there's been very poor defence from Saul, and Saul seems to be a very unenthusiastic leader and deliverer of his people. He's been suffering from very serious melancholy, as you know, and God has so worked upon him that he became utterly miserable and despondent and cast down. And the qualities that he had for leadership, and especially leadership in battle, that had been especially given to him of the Lord, had been removed from him because of his sin. But now here he is in a key position, and the people waiting upon him for a lead. David has been anointed king, but somewhat secretly. Only his family know about this. You know that he's come to court to serve Saul because of his reputation as a musician, as a harpist, and presumably also a singer of psalms. And the servants of Saul, the courtiers, as we saw in our last study, have told him that he's subjected to an illness sent to him by God, an evil spirit of the Lord, and yet rather than counselling him, urging him to make his peace with God and to repent, they suggest a very material solution, and they hit upon this finding a harpist and music to somehow soothe away his deep melancholy. And it's David who is produced, and he succeeds. And although it's not the ideal remedy, nevertheless, David being at court helps greatly to educate him in the ways of government and court life. But it would appear, but this is speculation, that he's playing this remedy, this musical remedy, superficial as it is, has been at any rate temporarily successful. And so David has been able to leave the royal court and go home. And that's the position at the beginning of chapter 7. But in verse 2, Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array. Well, it's fighting language, but it appears that the two armies just looked at each other for some considerable time. There may have been skirmishes, of course, to justify the word fighting, which is used in the narrative twice, but nevertheless, there was no real battle, and not until after the event with Goliath and David. And then it wasn't so much a battle as a rout, a pursuit. Verse 3, the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, a valley between. And verse 4, there went out a champion, one who stands between two, is the compound Hebrew word. There went out a champion, clearly a representative, to propose a duel, an individual duel, out of the camp of the Philistines, named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Now you're probably well familiar with what this involved. Generally speaking, his height is taken as being about 9.5 feet, according to the most popular estimate of the measurement, the cubit. However, there are some who argue that the cubit was little more than the popular measurement, and he may have been as tall as 11.5 feet. Well, certainly he was a giant, and he was descended, one would think, from the Anakim mentioned earlier on in the book of Joshua. Verse 5, he had an helmet of brass. For brass, it's better to read bronze. Now, these were undoubtedly made of a copper tin alloy, not a copper lead alloy, and that's well known. So for brass, read bronze. Not far off, but that's a better translation. An helmet of brass upon his head, armed with a coat of mail. And immediately, what is suggested to our minds is chain mail. But it wasn't chain mail, it was original mail, which would have been armour plates. Probably not very thick, but very strong, rather like fish scales. A suit of armour made in that way, with these scales somehow riveted together. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass, which the best estimates run at about 130 pounds. That's a tremendous amount of weight to carry about with you, but this man was a most powerful man and a giant of a man. Verse 6, he had greaves technically are shin pads, but here the Hebrew word suggests just leg armour. He had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. That's difficult to translate. Whatever did he have between his shoulders? Hardly a target in our understanding of the word, but the Hebrew suggests a kind of striking weapon, perhaps a great club of iron or a hammer of some kind. Modern translations often go for javelin, but some sort of a striking weapon is more likely. But anyway, he never had any opportunity to use it. And verse 7, the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, a huge thing. And his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And the experts tell us that's probably 15 to 16 pounds weight, just the head of this thing. And one bearing a shield went before him. The shields that were in use were full body shields. Assuming his armour bearer, his shield bearer, was about 6 feet, that by no means covered Goliath, but it protected his legs and abdomen, I suppose, from any furious archery assault, something of that kind. And verse 8, he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel, and said unto them, why are ye come out to set your battle in array? Why have you brought forces with you? Am not I a Philistine? And ye, servants, actually slaves, and you, the slaves of Saul. This is the tone in which it's all said, undoubtedly. Choose you a man for you, and let him come down to me. Down, you notice. At the moment, Goliath seems to have descended the mountain or hillside where the Philistines were, and is standing in that dry wadi at the bottom, shouting up to the Israelites. He seems, as his shouting goes on, because we're soon going to read, this went on over 40 days, a morning shout and a late afternoon or evening shout, one would guess. But as he does this and performs this ritual every day, he proceeds further and further into Israelite ground until he's so near that by the time David arrives and he bellows out his challenge, the soldiers nearest to him, the Israelites, scatter in fear. He's proceeding up into their ranks, possibly shout by shout. Verse 9, if he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then will we be your servants. Well, of course, Goliath was killed, but the Philistines never kept the terms of this duel, this engagement. They fled, rather. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall ye be our servants and serve us. But it's verse 10. Listen to this. The Philistine said, this is separated out. It's so important. And the Philistine also said, the narrative seems to slow down for this, I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. I defy the army of Israel. Well, obviously, the word defy is intended as an insult. I deprecate, I despise the armies of Israel. But it actually comes from the Hebrew verb to expose. And that's rather the sense. I expose the Israelite army. I expose you all. He says, this is the purpose of this challenge, your inferiority and your feebleness. I'm coming to challenge you as an individual to strip bare the impotence of this army of yours. That's the kind of language which is being used. And that word defy, from I expose you, has that type of ring about it. I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And this language had a tremendous effect, verse 11. When Saul heard these words, he was dismayed and greatly afraid. It starts with him. And if the king and the commander is terrified out of his wits and doesn't know what to do and where to turn, what about his generals around him, the officers nearest to him? Those that can see the dismay written on the face of the king and the utter demoralization of all Israel's army was taking place there. Even Jonathan, Saul's son, who had been so full of faith and so courageous on a previous incident and caused the tremendous flight of Philistines, even he doesn't come forward at this point. It's rather interesting that, bold and faithful as he had been before and as he would be in the future, I rather think that the previous time he was bold, he hadn't actually seen the enemy. They were concealed in the hills and so on, and he was very bold. But now, when there he is, very visible, and it's single encounter, even Jonathan's faith and courage seems to have failed him. He isn't actually mentioned. Maybe I'm being unfair to him, but here it is. Certainly Saul and all Israel are greatly afraid. And then the narrative switches suddenly to David, who isn't there at this stage. Verse 12, now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, Jesse, that is, the father of 8 sons, of whom David was the youngest, the 8th. And the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. And the 3 eldest sons of Jesse, who are later named, went and followed Saul to the battle. And they're named as Eliab, the firstborn, Abinadab, and Shammah. But David, being the youngest, wasn't sent by their father. Now this is interesting, because David had been anointed to be king, and his father knew that, and David knew that. And David must have wondered, well, Israel is under threat, I am anointed to be king, Saul has been rejected by God, should not I be there? Well, we're not told the details of his thinking at this stage, but as a very faithful young man, he obviously waited some definite word, some signal from the Lord. He waited in faith. He was being disparaged by people. Even his father, who knew he was anointed, set him out with the sheep and kept him from the great matters of state. Well, he must have wondered about that. Verse 15, David went and returned from Saul. He had returned from Saul earlier, that is, to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And then you switch back to the scene where the battle lines were drawn up. Verse 16, the Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. I would imagine that just as he had this immense build and stature, so he must have had a mighty roar, roaring across the valley and then up from the river bed to be heard by a large army of many thousands for this challenge to ring out for an individual duel. But Jesse, in verse 17, happened at this point to say to David his son, take now for thy brethren corn and bread, and it says here, and run to the camp. But there's a Hebrew word later which strongly implies that he had a carriage and so on, and no doubt donkeys or horses to operate it. And run to the camp, verse 18, and carry these 10 cheeses, which could have been enormous, but that's speculation, unto the captain of their thousand, of their brigade, the colonel or brigadier of their brigade. And look how thy brethren fare, and take their pledge. I shouldn't waste time with this, but take their pledge. All the modern translations go for something quite different. They make something quite different out of the Hebrew phrase. But the Hebrew is quite clear, take their pledge. Well, the old writers were certain they knew what it meant, pay their debts. These sons of Jesse were probably not terribly reliable people, and they'd gone to the front there and were probably running up debts for food and so on, and it's a term which could mean something like that. Honour their pledges, pay their debts, settle their affairs. Verse 19, it's not terribly relevant to the battle, but it's a little insight. Verse 19, now Saul and they, that is the three sons of Jesse, and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. As I say, the fighting hadn't technically started, but that word may be justified by skirmishes going on here and there. And verse 20, David rose up early in the morning, left the sheep, went as Jesse had commanded, came to the trench as the host was going forth to the fight. The line was moving forward, and everyone was shouting for the battle, and it's implied he joined with them. Well, the Orientals of that time did an awful lot of shouting, sometimes more shouting than fighting, working up courage, inspiring everybody. Battle was a noisy business. And verse 21, Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array, army against army. Verse 22, David left his carriage. The Hebrew says something like equipment. Carriage is probably a perfectly good guess. In the hand of the keeper of the carriage, ran into the army and located, found and saluted his brethren. But at this point, that 23rd verse, Goliath came out of the armies of the Philistines and spake according to the same word that we read earlier on. Verse 8, am not I a Philistine, and ye slaves to Saul? And then verse 10, I defy, expose the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man to fight. This was probably the morning call. 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, who knows? But the morning shout of Goliath. And verse 24, he'd come now, well, it says so in verse 23, it says he'd come up. There came up the champion. He's going up the hill on the Israel's side. And verse 24, when they saw the man, that no doubt the nearest people just shrank away from him and were sore afraid. And so David was told, they were all saying to any newcomers, have you seen this man? Surely to defy, to expose Israel, is he come? There's very little faith among them. They're very defeatist, in spite of the blessings they've had. And then an interesting piece of information, halfway through verse 25, which David didn't know about, evidently. that Saul had said, and it had been spread round the army, that the man who kills him, Saul's looking for a champion. He can't do it himself. He doesn't know anyone who can. He's a desperate man. The king will enrich him with great riches and give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. So verse 26, David spoke to the men near him and he asked this question. It doesn't sound a very wholesome question if you don't think about it. What shall be done to the man that killeth this Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel? What shall be done? Almost looks as though David is looking for what the reward is, first of all. But you have to remember that he is anointed to be king. And when he hears this extravagant offer that Saul is prepared to greatly enrich whoever can defeat Goliath and marry him into his household, that has implications for David. What does this mean? David thinks to himself, is this how the Lord is going to work? Is this how I'm going to be brought into the kingdom? That I will defeat Goliath and thereby be brought into royal status? Or is this going to be a complication for me in that somebody else possibly is going to defeat Goliath and he will be preferred and I will have to wait longer? So there are all sorts of reasons why David would ask this question, other than his being motivated by personal gain. And anyway, he is increasingly determined that the Lord would have him to do this, to carry out this mission. And verse 27, the people answered him and told him that was indeed what Saul had offered. But Eliab, in verse 28, listen to him. When he heard David, his anger was kindled against him. Why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know thy pride and the naughtiness, the insolence of thine heart, for thou art come down just to see an historic event. Now, it's very interesting what Elias has to say to him, because Eliab rather sees no spiritual issue here. He doesn't grasp. He doesn't have any sense of his place as an Israelite, of his purpose in life. He seems to have no spiritual view at all. He doesn't seem to know the promises of God. Never occurs to him. This is a spiritual event, not merely any physical battle. This is God being blasphemed and the armies of Israel. And Israel is likely to be enslaved. God's people at that time. And the promises of God are with his people. And if they pray to him and repent and forsake idolatry and pray for help, he has absolutely promised to be with them and to fight for them and give them victory. This is a spiritual matter and this has to be proved. And God has to be vindicated. There's no sense of any of that in Eliab. He can only imagine that David, using this rather militant language, which suggests this man ought to be dealt with, one of us ought to do something about this, that this man is just being insolent and impertinent and ridiculous. And so he speaks to him along those lines. And in verse 29, David said, what have I now done? Is there not a cause? And that's a very special word. It means, is there not a basis for action? A motive for rising up against Goliath? Is there not here a great spiritual issue? A great spiritual cause? Well, of course, Eliab hadn't seen it. But sometimes we're like that. Let's just do a little personal application by way of review. Our existence as God's people is a spiritual issue. It's not that we've been born, very good, we've grown up, we happen to have come to the Lord and we love him and we worship him, but our main assignment is to live reasonably successfully in this life, look after our families and so on, and live righteously with the help of God before him? Is that all it is? We're here just for life in this world and we happen to be converted and belong to him. Or are we gathered here as a church for a great spiritual cause? And do we look at life in this way? And what happens to every one of us in the providence and goodness of God is part of a tremendous battle for souls and for men and women for all eternity, and to represent God and to defeat the armies of Satan. Eliab couldn't see any of this. David, you see, could see it all very clearly. Is there not a cause? Is this not part of the great spiritual battle and mission and cause? Well, what about us, dear friends? Say, I love the Lord, I trust in his shed blood, but of course your exams are important and your career is important, your money, your pay, and you're looking after your family and giving them a decent living and so on. All these things are important. But is it not much more important to see life in a spiritual context and the great cause and mission, and to be part of it and part of the service of the Lord? This is a great passage here. Is there not a cause, a motive, a strong reason to be standing against Goliath? Is God not in this? And as he turned from him toward another, verse 30, and spake after the same manner. And more as he speaks, it is evident he is prepared to go himself. And the people answer him. Now look at verse 31. And when the words were heard which David spake, they rehearsed them before Saul. Was that an accident? There's a vast crowd there. There are many thousands of soldiers, officers, organized troops. How did this happen? Did it happen to happen? Oh no, don't forget David had been a courtier. David was himself familiar with a lot of the people at court. In fact, Saul himself. And so it's fairly evident that in speaking to people and saying, we should act, this man should be confronted, and implying that he himself would do it, that he deliberately spoken this to members of court, perhaps even to Abner, one of Saul's generals, who crops up in a few verses' time. And so inevitably, his words are reported to Saul, and he sent for him. Verse 32, and David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Thy servant will go and fight with this Philistine. These are precious words, you know. Let no man's heart fail because of him. Now, sadly, the majority of Israelites were faithless, probably idolaters, and their hearts had already failed. But what David is doing, he's speaking for the remnant. There always was a minority in the Jewish nation, a remnant of people who trusted in God and prayed to him. And no doubt David has them in mind. He knows that if he is to succeed, it will be by divine power, and it will also be through the prayers of the true church, that remnant of believing souls in Israel. Let no man's heart fail, thy servant will go and fight. And Saul's reaction immediately, verse 33, is cynical. Thou art not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for thou art but a youth. David was at least 20 by this time, and we know from previous descriptions of him that he was no mean lad, even at 20. He was obviously pretty stocky and powerful and well built, but nevertheless still he was young and fresh of complexion and inexperienced and unmarked. Whereas, of course, this giant of a man, this Philistine, Goliath, had been a man of war from his youth. He was absolutely no match. Well, we've seen from the description, which was rather laboured earlier in the chapter, not only the size of Goliath, but the weaponry that he carried. And the picture is laboured to tell us this man was invincible. It was impossible that he could be brought down by anyone who the Israelites would have at their disposal. This is an impossible mission. And yet David, anointed of God, a man after God's heart, a man of faith, grasps the promises and they give him courage. God has said he will be with us. This is his battle. And David said unto Saul, he answers him very carefully, "You're inexperienced," says Saul. Yes, David seems to say in verse 34, "I may be inexperienced in warfare." You won't find these words that I'm saying, I'm reading them in, but this is the sense. "I may be inexperienced in warfare, but I am very experienced in individual hand-to-hand battle and confrontation. Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock." And most of the old writers think that this wasn't an individual experience for David. However, he recounts it as a one-off occasion. "And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him." So he speaks of his experience of dueling, as it were, of individual conflict. "Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine," which is not an insult, it's not derogatory language, it's spiritual language. This man is outside the field of God's favour, and his enemy, and bitterly against him, and insulting him. He's not one of those under promise, and so he shall be as one of those, seeing he hath defied, insulted, and purported to expose the armies of the living God, the armies that are under the promise of God, if they believe and act. And so there's this great utterance of faith in verse 37. These things all have application for us. I'm not surprised David was underestimated. Not surprised he was underestimated by his brothers, by the people who heard him volunteer, or by Saul. Because in spite of the fact that I've asserted the descriptions of him suggest that he was a very stocky and tough young man, nevertheless, he was gentle in his manner and disposition. He was very fair of countenance, unmarked and young-looking. He could easily be underestimated. He'd been at court. He'd been at court as harpist to King Saul, as well as armor-bearer, aide-de-camp. He'd been his harpist. And so his whole manner was very gentle. He was like a nurse to Saul in the way he consoled him and treated him and played to him. And so that gave Saul and others the impression this young man would be hopeless for this task, and altogether inadequate. But we learn a lesson from this. As far as God is concerned, and in spiritual matters, for the people of God, tenacity, faith, courage, immense strength is not inconsistent with meekness and gentleness. In fact, they go together for Christian people. We are commanded to be meek. It's a fruit of the Spirit. We're commanded to be gentle. We're commanded to be always courteous and kind and sensitive and feelingful. Yet we are also commanded spiritually in faith to be strong and to be courageous, to be very bold and courageous in witness, in standing up to wrong and to the devil. And we are those who are to stand up in the most taxing and testing of circumstances. Well, you don't have to be ferocious. Don't think it's only the world that equates strength and success with great pride and confidence and a rough manner and haughtiness. The great triumph of the Spirit of God is people, Christian people, are made gentle and kind and affectionate, and yet people of tremendous strength and courage. These things go together. But it means that the world underestimates the Christian. And so David was greatly underestimated. Well, let me go down anyway to the fact that here in verse 37, David rehearses the Lord. He gives all the credit to the Lord. The Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion and out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine. And Saul is quite carried away. Saul was a very emotional man sometimes. But I think by the work of the Spirit, he realized that David was God's instrument. And he said to David, "Go, and the Lord be with thee." Well, I shall just skip over the verses where Saul arms David with his armor and puts his helmet of brass or bronze upon his head. And David, I think out of courtesy more than anything, affects to try to move in this, realizing he can't possibly do so. It's too big for him. Saul was an immensely tall man, and he wasn't used to using it anyway, and this armor wasn't necessary for his purpose. He was going to prove the Lord. And so verse 40, you're familiar with this, I'm sure. He took his staff in his hand and chose him 5 smooth stones out of the brook. The experts say they might have been about 2 inches in diameter, that the slingers of olden times used very large stones and could so project them that they would reach a speed of 100-150 miles an hour. In past incidents, occasions when I've touched upon this subject, I've usually found that we've a surprising number of people in the congregation who are secret experts in ballistics and slings in particular, and seem to have read all sorts of interesting things and even practiced all sorts of interesting things. But I think the general consensus is that this was not the best weapon to take into a battle upon which so much hung. Well, back in the book of Judges, we read of an elite force of 700 Israelites who could sling a shot to an hair's breadth. But nevertheless, it was never the weapon of choice and the weapon of greatest accuracy, though it may well have been in the hands of some. It's a primitive, rural type of instrument to take into such a vital battle. I shall be contradicted later, I know. But that's the general opinion. Well, he took his staff and these 5 smooth stones and drew near to the Philistine. And verse 41, the Philistine came on and drew near unto David, not comprehending, it seems, at this stage, that David was his challenger. And the man that bare the shield went before him. And verse 42, when the Philistine looked about and saw David detached from the army and coming toward him, he could scarcely believe his eyes. No armor, no sword, no spear, dressed as a shepherd. It was an insult to see such a person coming. But he disdained him, is the word our translators have chosen. A word in the Hebrew which means he disesteemed him. He regarded him with utter contempt. He is nothing. He's just a youth. Unproven. Unmarked youth. Not clad in any armor. No weapons of offense except this feeble sling, he might well have thought. And he shows offense. David is carrying just a staff along with that sling. And the Philistine said unto David, "Am I a dog? You come to me like a shepherd. Am I your sheepdog? And you bring a stick that can dominate your dog, and you think it can dominate me?" Astonishing. And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said, "Come to me, and I will give thy flesh unto the fowls of the air and to the beasts of the field," probably meaning that your flesh will become offerings to my gods. Then David said to the Philistine, Thou comest to me with a sword and with a spear and with a shield, but I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts. Now this is very precious to us and valuable. I turn momentarily to Joshua chapter 5, verse 13. These are great words. It came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho years and years earlier, that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, Art thou for us or for our adversaries? And he said, these are the words, Nay, but as captain of the host of the Lord am I now come. Well, it was a theophany. Joshua had the Lord who named himself as captain of the host of the Lord. And that's precisely the term which David uses in 1 Samuel 17, verse 45. But I come to thee in the name of the Lord of hosts. David, he grasps the spiritual significance of the occasion, and he's deeply familiar with the ancient names of God, and he uses one here, the Lord of hosts, the God of heaven's hosts, is the literal meaning of the Hebrew. I come to thee in the name of the God of heaven's hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom thou hast denied. He ascribes all glory to him in these verses. You read through verses 45 and 46 and 47, and they amount to this, that God is going to deliver you into our hands today as a mighty demonstration of his power. It will be a witness to you, Philistines, that God is with us. It will be a witness to unbelieving Israelites that God is with us. What is going to happen will be entirely by the power of God, and it will be a most salutary witness and testimony to God's promises and his power. And this is tremendous. You know, I often mention this, we overpraise sometimes historic preachers. Take John Wesley. Amazing his travels. Even when he was old, an old man, there he would be battling through Scottish mountains in deep snow, nobody prepared to travel with him to get to the town, the other side of a mountain, where he'd agreed to preach. Amazing man, remarkable man. But then we have to remember this. Praise John Wesley for his travels, but praise God for the souls. All credit to that man for what he was willing to do in the body. But when he preached, don't say it was Wesley's preaching that knocked them over. It was Wesley's preaching that stirred their hearts. It was Wesley's preaching that won souls. It was the arrow of conviction of the Lord of hosts entering hearts. And never forget that. And when we speak of great preachers and all that they've accomplished and what they've done, I think we rightly trace their dedication and their labours, but we shouldn't go on and give them the credit for the souls. And that's what David is very careful to maintain here, his balance. It's all credit to the Lord, all the way through. So when you think of what happened, don't say to yourself, what an amazing shot. What an amazing slinger. What an astonishing strategy on the part of David. Wasn't it brilliant how he brought him down? Say no. All credit to him for his courage, his forwardness, his trust in the Lord, that he was prepared to fight. But all credit and glory to the Lord, because what happened was a miracle. It's too extraordinary for David to have accomplished that, unaided by the Lord. And that's the purpose of this narrative. That's why at the front end of the narrative, Goliath is massively built up and made invincible. And when the verse about his execution comes, it's all over in a second. And why do you think the Philistines ran for their lives? Why didn't they say, our champion is down, now we've got to fight this out, we're not going to be slaves. We've come here because we believed we could prevail, now let's get on with it. Why suddenly did they turn tail and run? Because they saw a miracle. They knew perfectly well the shepherd boy, stocky as he might have been, armed with only rural weaponry, could not prevail over Goliath. But he did, and they were all convinced, this is the ancient Israel all over again. God is with them, they will be invincible, and they ran. And the Israelites too realized this was a miracle, and they were ashamed, and they ran after them and pursued them, filled with courage. So I move to conclusion with just a few considerations here. Verse 47, and all this assembly shall know. In David's mind, this is the principal thing. All this assembly shall know that the Lord saveth not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. And it came to pass when the Philistine arose, maybe his armor bearer had found him a seat through all this. He was carrying so much armor, it would have been welcome, I'm sure. And came and drew nigh to meet David, that David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And he put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sunk into his forehead, through the metalwork that was there in all probability. Some old writers said he must have been too overconfident and pushed up his visor. But we don't know about that. But anyway, the stone knocked him clean out. Although the word slew is used, it's used again later, he seems to have been completely unconscious. Not surprising he fell forward with all that weight on the end of his spear and so on. His balance must have been tilted forward. Verse 50, so David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone. That's not said in order to get credit to David. The inspired word says it to emphasize the miraculous element in all this. And smote the Philistine and slew him. But there was no sword in the hand of David. So he ran and stood upon the Philistine, who in this verse seems to be unconscious but alive, all the more humiliating that the onlookers should see him slain, incapable of defending himself. Took his sword, drew it out of the sheath thereof, and slew him and cut off his head. And when the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. Oh, dear friends, can you imagine this scene? When the two were facing each other, and the people of Israel must have thought to themselves, what has our king done? Our future now is in the hands of this impossible, this young man, who is virtually unarmed. And there is this invincible champion of the Philistines, and they must have shuddered in horror and fear and even anger that such a one should be sent forth. And the Philistines must have leered with contempt and victory in their nostrils and certain that this was just going to end in this young man's early death. And there were no doubt the faithful in Israel, the few who couldn't understand this, but they prayed. And there were some who might have been extremely anxious, but they were sympathetic to see such an underdog going against such a powerful champion. You can only imagine all the emotions. And then in a flash, it's all over and it's finished and they're having to pursue the enemy. Well, let me conclude with these thoughts. What does this tell us and have to do with us? Friends, David, the young David. Wonderful things happened to him. The Lord's deliverance from wild animals, the anointing to be king over Israel, Then Goliath, the slaying of Goliath, which was in effect his public presentation to the nation of Israel. Now they would see him for the first time. Mark you, he's a type of Christ in this, isn't he? We haven't time to explore this. One man saves the whole nation. He's a type of our Lord and Saviour, Jesus Christ, who went alone to Calvary to take upon himself our suffering and be our champion and our deliverer. So David had immense blessings, but he also had endless troubles. He had to be so patient before his life's work could begin. He had to be abused by his older brothers. He had to be in service, subservient to others. His father, his brothers, looking after the sheep. Saul as his musician and armor bearer. Then for years he was a fugitive from the venom of Saul. And then after he became king, he was betrayed over and over again and given enormous problems and troubles. And early in his life, with the lion and the bear, and then with Goliath, he learned this. David, said the Lord to him, you've got to fight. I will secure the victory, but you must pick up arms and you must fight. And that's the lesson for us here. We as Christian people will have wonderful blessings. We have conversion, the experience of coming to Christ. We have so many answers to prayer. We have so many interventions in our lives and wonderful things. But we also have tests, tests of faith. We also are on a training course where the Lord is training us in character and strength to serve him. And some of the training is hard for us. We have the enemy of souls against us. We have to fight for holiness and strive. And we have to put up with all the hostility of the world against Christ and against his people. We are going to be pictured in the life of David. Great blessings, great trials and tests also. Do you have this spiritual view of life? You're only one person. You and me, we're the same. One small person. What do we count? And yet we're part of a great spiritual objective and campaign and battle. And we are appointed for victories, blessings, wonderful things. And we are also appointed while on earth for trials and hardship and training and defending the faith and the Lord. All this will be reflected in studies in Saul and David. Let's close this evening singing the hymn 463.